How does climate change affect health? And what can medical professionals do about it? Those are the very questions we hope to answer here on Code Green, the Climate Smart Health Professional. I'm Liana Haggis, your host for today's episode. In this episode, we're going to take a dive into climate, equity, and advocacy with pediatrician Dr. Lisa Patel. Dr. Patel is a clinical assistant professor of pediatrics at Stanford. She was a former presidential management fellow for the EPA and is currently on the executive committee for the American Academy of Pediatrics National Council on Environmental Health. She is also the advocacy and policy lead for the Sean N. Parker Center for Allergy and Asthma Research. Dr. Patel, it's an honor to have you here with us. To start us off, can you tell us your climate and health story? What led you to work at this unique intersection of fields?
Yeah, that's a long story. So I'll tell you like a shorter version of it. Basically, when I was in college, I started working initially in ecology, and I started to see what the impacts of basically the degradation of the environment meant for human health. And that led me into a path of going to medical school, deciding to do my training in pediatrics because the health harms I saw were the greatest in children. And that's kind of what led me in eventually into working specifically on climate change and health. Is understanding that our longstanding practices of how we've used and abused the environment is poor for both the health of our children and the health of our planet.
How does climate affect the health of children? And what makes them vulnerable to changes in our environment?
Yeah, there are several things that are at play. So first of all, is how rapidly a child is developing and growing in the beginning. So children, for example, breathe faster than adults do. So when there's air pollution in the atmosphere, they are, for body mass, breathing in more of that pollution because of the rate at which they're breathing. Children in the beginning are very exploratory. They, as they learn about the world, they're constantly putting things into their mouth. And if they live in an environment that's toxic with things like lead or arsenic that are in the environment, that can certainly affect their long-term development as well. I mean, I think places like Flint, Michigan are a great example in terms of what lead toxicity can do for long-term children's health. And then there are as well, you know, there is an understanding around toxic stress and what that does to children. And toxic stress can take so many different forms, poverty, racism, housing, and all of these things are linked to things that are going on with climate change. You know, children being displaced, children losing their parents or caretakers themselves suffering from mental illness, from themselves being displaced. All of these things have a long-term effect on children's health and their health outcomes. We know that for each adverse effect a child faces, it places them at higher lifetime risk for things like diabetes, cancer, heart disease. So all of these things really stack up for us understanding that we need to do our all to make sure that the environment a child is growing up in is healthy and stable and nurturing.
Wow. Yeah, I can only imagine. How has your background in ecology shaped how you practice medicine?
I think I approach things with a far more structural lens as a result. You know, when I see a child come in with an asthma attack, I'm not just thinking about what medications their parents did or didn't give to them. I think about the structural reasons that brought this child to my door. Mm-hmm. Where do they live? What has been their parents' access to health insurance? What is their access to get these medications? Is it difficult for them to get? Do they have the coverage to get it? Do they have the money? And then what is their home like? Like, are both parents working three jobs? And several of their children have asthma, so that it's so hard for them to be able to keep on top of making sure that each child can remain healthy, mm-hmm. right? I'm thinking about all of these larger structural issues that resulted in this child coming to my door, because climate change too is the mother of all structural issues, right? When we think about how we've arrived at this place, you can't you can't just look at it as a patient by patient issue in terms of the health issues that arrive at your door. You have to ask yourself why they're there. How did they get there? We know that between a third to a half of the health outcomes in our patients are the result of social determinants of health. And so we really need to understand that if we're going to be good doctors.
Right, of course. So when these types of concerns come up with patients, do you ever discuss ways to access resources that they may need?
To be honest to your question, we are poorly prepared in terms of resources that we can offer our families. And families themselves may not always know what resources to turn to. So I've made it a practice now, for example, I talk to all of my families about how to bundle their newborns, how to mm-hmm. keep them safe, for example. And then when I know that we're in a phase of the year where it's hot, I will talk to them about if they don't have access to cooling within their home, making sure that they know that every county is supposed to have a cooling center where they can go to stay safe from the heat, for example. But in terms of, you know, families themselves being able to install an air conditioner, being able to pay those energy bills, these are long-term things that local and state governments need to start thinking about in terms of ensuring that communities can stay resilient during heat waves.
Yeah, absolutely. You work in Northern California. So you know that last year, the state experienced the worst wildfire season on record. Could you maybe explain why these wildfires are occurring more often and how climate change plays a role?
What we know is that it's a combination of factors, but climate change is certainly a driver in terms of the intensity, the severity, and the duration of the wildfires that we're seeing. This year was particularly catastrophic for a number of reasons. So one, we have had worsening droughts in California, and this year as well, we just didn't get the same amount of precipitation. So things were excessively dry to begin with. Second of all, we had this terrible heat wave that dried things out even further. And what's really interesting about the way the planet is heating up is, you know, you don't just look at daytime temperatures for the peak temperature during the day, but you also look at what's happening at nighttime. Mm-hmm. California is a place where, you know, we tend to get hot during the day, but we cool down pretty significantly at night. But during these last few heat waves, both our daytime and our nighttime temperatures have been excessive. So that when those first wildfires started in August, because excessively dry, excessively hot, excessively dried out conditions, wildfires started. Well, it was hot during the day, it was hot during the night. The firefighters never caught a break in terms of being able to contain those wildfires because at night it was hot too. So the fires just kept spreading and spreading and spreading out of control. And this is because of climate change. This isn't because of land use alone.
Now, I remember last fall, you posted a tweet about a time when, because of power outages, you cared for patients in a hospital without any electricity. Could you tell us more about that story and describe your experience working in that kind of setting?
This was one of the wildfire seasons we had, I think a year or two ago, that was instigated, that basically happened because of some faulty electrical wiring by PG&E. Mm-hmm. So what ended up happening was PG&E went through various areas and just started cutting power. And I was working on one of my 24-hour shifts, and it was around 9 p.m. and the power just went out in our hospital without any warning. They hadn't told us that this was happening. The power just went out. And this to me was a lesson in why it's so important for hospitals to know what their emergency plans are and have regular training with their staff, because we had to figure it all out on the fly that night. And we learned through the experience that the backup generators, thankfully, worked in the NICU and worked in the laboring rooms, but did not work in the postpartum rooms. So the postpartum rooms, where the moms had just delivered their babies, were pitch black dark. And so these moms are just stumbling around in the dark, right? Everything just goes dark all of a sudden. And we're all like, what's happened? And thankfully, I work with a really talented group of nurses who just sprung to action and went to several places. We found our stash of flashlights. We went to those moms' rooms, got them their flashlights while we sorted the situation out. But you know, thankfully there wasn't anything terrible happening that night in terms of bad cases that we had to deal with that night in terms of patient care. Cause I was just imagining some scenario where, you know, if a mom like fell down, for example, if a mom rolled on top of a baby. I mean, I've had a few situations in hospitals where the mother rolls on the infant in the middle of the night and the baby stops breathing, and then you're running a code on the baby inside of a postpartum room that's all black. Like, how would you go about doing something like that? So it was a really sobering moment to sort of understand that the world is not structured to take care of us. Like, we really need to make sure that we are well aware of all of our contingency plans, emergency planning, if needed, to be able to continue caring for our patients uninterrupted, regardless of what's going on in our surroundings.
Absolutely. It really reinforces the fact that we need to make our healthcare systems more resilient to climate change. And the lack of adaptability in our healthcare system has really been brought to light by the COVID pandemic. Let's pivot a bit towards the idea of community resilience. As a pediatrician, how have you seen your local community respond to the crises of climate change, systemic racism, and COVID-19?
I think what I've seen this year is just because of our systematic disinvestment in public health. Our families that have been made vulnerable by poverty and racism have been made to suffer in ways that are just unconscionable to me. Families had a new baby in their home. They didn't have air conditioning. The air pollution outside was terrible. They're like, how do I keep my baby safe? Mm-hmm. If I open the windows, in comes this toxic pollution. If I close the windows, it's too hot for all of us. Like, what do we do? And there was no good answer for them. You know, we came up with mitigation strategies. There are DIY cheap filters that you can build to at least reduce the load of air pollution within your homes, for example, but none of these are perfect, and far from perfect at that. And we knew that the people who were able to stay safe during this confluence of pandemic, wildfire, heat wave in September and October were those that were very rich and privileged. You know, people, frankly, like myself, where we live in a home where we can stay cool. We have several air purifiers, and I could protect my children from the worst effects of climate change. But so many families in the Bay Area did not have that privilege.
What are some other ways that structural inequity and racism make some communities more vulnerable to climate change?
I mean, to me, the biggest one is redlining. For listeners that don't know, this was a historic practice by the Homeowners Loan Corporation in the 1930s. They basically literally drew a red line around neighborhoods that were primarily of a Black population, and then would not give any homes in that area loans to be able to buy houses or improve upon their homes. And what that has resulted in, you know, decades down the line, is that these communities and these households have substantially less in wealth because they were never given the capital to begin with, never given the same opportunities as populations that had a higher white percent population. So, and it's not just a question of finances. What has happened with that systematic disinvestment is, you know, you don't have as many parks there. You have industry, polluting industry that moves into these neighborhoods as well. And with those polluting industries, we know these communities are exposed to higher levels of pollution from things like PM2.5 that affects their long-term health. So to me, for example, when I see a child that comes in, particularly, for example, one that lives in West Oakland, West Oakland is circled on all sides by freeways and freeway projects as well. Freeway projects were built in neighborhoods where they felt like there wouldn't be any real resistance to a freeway being built across those neighborhoods. So the kids in those communities are several fold times higher risk for asthma compared to kids in other neighborhoods. And that's nothing they did. That is what we as a society have done to them.
Right. Why do you think that it's especially important for physicians to engage in advocacy work, especially around climate change and social inequities?
Knowing how much of our patients' health is determined outside of our traditional thought about what medicine is. So, you know, a third to a half of their health being determined by social determinants of health, to me says that our work as doctors really need, a lot of it needs to take place outside of the bounds of just our clinics or our hospitals if what we're fighting for is for our patients' health. So Gallup runs this poll where they ask the public who they're most willing to trust, who are trusted messengers. And the top three are in the medical profession. Nurses are number one, doctors are number two, pharmacists are number three, with at the bottom being like car salespeople and members of Congress. So we are highly, highly trusted members of society. And knowing that and knowing what the impact of climate change is on health and understanding that climate change is an equity issue, I think it is our duty as physicians to be counseling our patients. But added to that, patients themselves want to hear from us about climate change. One of my colleagues in Pittsburgh, Maya Raghavan, is going to be publishing sometime this year on a study she did looking at families' attitudes towards climate change. And she found it was surprised all of us how many families wanted to hear from their providers about climate change and how it affects their child's health.
What are some ways that pediatricians and pediatricians in training can get involved in this work?
So I it took me a while to find my space and my place in advocacy. And I think the reason why I struggled for a long time, and I hope to save others the struggle, because it can be so easy. The secret sauce to me is to find your community and get going. Advocacy is hard and it can feel overwhelming. And so to me, the best way to get started is to find other colleagues that are passionate about the same issues you are. So if you are interested in pediatrics, the American Academy of Pediatrics actually hosts something called the legislative conference in the spring. This year, it's actually, they're just doing a broad array of advocacy skills because we can't go to our individual legislators in DC and advocate. We in Northern California have an Advocating for Children Together conference to help people get connected to others that are interested in advocacy. So opportunities like that are a great way to get involved. AAP has actually created a climate advocates program. So there is at least one pediatrician who's been identified as a climate advocate for the state in every state in the United States of America. So even if you're not interested in pediatrics, if you don't know where to look or where to go, you can reach out to your local AAP chapter and try to find out who the climate advocate is. And that person is likely connected to lots of other health professionals in their state who are passionate on this topic. Within some states, they actually already have organizations for clinicians and health professionals that are organized around climate change. States like Ohio, Florida, Virginia, California, just to name a few, that have organizations that are of clinicians dedicated to fighting climate change, approaching it from a health equity point of view. I wouldn't say that there's like one thing you can do on your own that makes as much of a difference as joining a group and doing something together with someone else.
Absolutely. Now, many medical students look up to you as a pioneer and a physician mentor in this field of climate change and health. What does a typical week look like for you? How do you balance climate advocacy, teaching, clinical work, and time to care for yourself and your family?
These are all fantastic questions. And I will start by saying that healthcare is unfortunately a business. I start by saying that because I think many of us come into healthcare wanting to become doctors because we are interested in service. And there is this profound philosophical disconnect between many of us who come into this profession wanting to serve and then being a part of, frankly, what is a very capitalistic system of wanting to produce profits. Mm-hmm. And so my first few years as an attending, where I just felt, frankly, really demoralized and almost ready to quit clinical medicine because I felt like this wasn't the system I wanted to participate in. I felt like my only value to the system was how many, they're called work RVUs, which is like how much you bill. That was constantly the incentive, is how much do you bill? How much do you bill? How much do you bill? And anytime I would bring up issues around, my concerns around like patients that we were turning away because of health insurance or other issues like that, I was basically told to be grateful to have a job and just keep going. and I found this all very demoralizing given why I came into this profession. And that's when I started drawing boundaries for myself. That's when I came to this reckoning of what this profession is and who I wanted to be within it. I still do my clinical practice, but I draw a line around that. And I say, okay, this I'm doing because this is It's important for me to stay connected to a clinical practice, to be able to advocate on behalf of my patients. I need to know what they're going through in a very intimate way. Mm-hmm. But over time, I've tried to kind of decrease that time little by little and increase my time working in other spaces. No, unfortunately, academics isn't set up to pay you to do it upfront. there are many ways to go about getting compensated or getting recognized to do this work. But many times you do have to start doing it on your own time and prove your worth to your academic institution for them to eventually give you something called the FTE to do it. And so I first started working in advocacy because 2016 happened, and I was thinking to myself, this is not the world I want my kids to live in. I'm going to fight like hell. And so I started getting involved, much more involved in advocacy after 2016. I did a lot of work in that space. And from that work, an opportunity opened up at Stanford to teach the residents on advocacy. It was a small amount of FTE to do it. But because I kind of had built up my resume in the space, they reached out to me for the opportunity, and I took it. It's a matter of building the skills that can be important to the university in terms of what they need from you. And I'll say a place that I think is very easy or easier to get in to get protected time to do work is either in research or in teaching. Me doing advocacy education, this is something that serves the residents. So I can get FTE around something like that. But this is also to say, leave no stone unturned. Like, email whoever, as many people as you can. You never know which path is going to lead you towards an opportunity that can turn into something substantive for your career. So keep putting your feelers out there, keep reaching out to people, particularly people that you admire or respect. Set up conversations with folks, tell people what you're interested in or what you're passionate about. Have a concrete sense of what you want so that if this mentor happens to come across an opportunity that matches what you want, they can reach back out to you and be like, hey, I heard about this great opportunity, you should apply. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say that there's any beaten or trodden path, but just know what you want and keep trying.
Yeah, that's incredible advice. As we come out of the COVID-19 pandemic, there's been conversation around using this time as an opportunity to restructure our health systems. What are some of the elements that you think would be really important to address in order to prepare ourselves for the climate crisis?
This doesn't seem directly climate change related, but I feel like most meetings I walk into, I'm like, we have to do three things: reparations, universal basic income, universal healthcare. I mean, to me, we cannot have a conversation around equity before we talk about those three things. And I'd encourage everybody to read the fantastic piece by Mary Bassett and Sandro Galea in the New England Journal of Medicine, where they talk about how reparations wouldn't necessarily fix racism, but it recognizes this profound resource gap that can be traced back to slavery, around which where people live and how that affects their health is a huge one. And reparations can go a long way in addressing that persistent disparity that has resulted in all of these inequities that we see. Those three things to me are necessary to any conversation we have around climate change, health, and equity, because this gets at what this is all about, which is ensuring that every child has a fair shot at a healthy future, a thriving future. And I don't think we can get there until we address those three things.
If you could choose one thing to have listeners really take away from this episode, what would it be?
I would say find your community of people and get working. That's what I think is really important. I think all of us need to find a way to get involved. And I think realistically, you will get involved, stay involved, and have fun doing it if you find your community to do it with.
Do you have anything else you'd like us to link in the description of this episode?
I think the only other one I would mention, Oxfam put out a really interesting one, sort of looking at, and I think people know this data, the report on confronting carbon inequality. So kind of understanding that the richest 10% of the world is responsible for half of our cumulative carbon emissions, while the poorest 50% were responsible for a mere 7%. And so I think that's another kind of good report to look at as we're thinking about who is responsible for the situation we're in and our obligation to act on it.
Incredible. Thank you so much for being here, Dr. Patel. And that's it for today's episode. Thank you for tuning in to Code Green, the climate smart health professional. This episode was hosted and sound edited by Liana Haggis. The episode script and interview was written by Natasha Sood and Sarah Hsu. We also want to acknowledge the Indigenous lands that we're recording from. I'm recording from Providence, Rhode Island, which sits on the occupied land of the Narragansett Nation. Dr. Patel is speaking to us from Stanford, California, which sits on the traditional homeland of the Mawekma Ohlone tribe. And lastly, we want to hear from you. Just send us an email at codegreenclimatepod@gmail.com or DM us on social media. Our Instagram is @codegreenclimatepod and our Twitter is @codegreenpod. Please don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review this show. Thank you again for tuning in to Code Green, the climate smart health professional. We'll see you next time.